Chapter 11. Intimate Relations of Cause and Effect. Shortly after leaving school, he accompanied a party of friends to a cricket field, in his natural and appropriate character of spectator only. On the ground it was discovered that the players fell short of the required number, and Facile Thomas was persuaded to assist in making up the complement. At a certain appointed time, he was roused from peaceful slumber in a dry ditch, and placed before three wickets with a bat in his hand. Opposite to him, behind three more wickets, stood one of his bosom friends, filling the situation, as he was informed, of bowler. No words can describe Mr. Idle's horror and amazement when he saw this young man on ordinary occasions, the meekest and mildest of human beings, suddenly contract his eyebrows, compress his lips, assume the aspect of an infuriated savage, run back a few steps, then run forward, and, without the slightest previous provocation, hurl a detestably hard ball with all his might straight at Thomas's legs. Stimulated to preternatural activity of body and sharpness of eye by the instinct of self-preservation, Mr. Idle contrived, by jumping deftly aside at the right moment, and by using his bat, ridiculously narrow as it was for the purpose, as a shield, to preserve his life and limbs from the dastardly attack that had been made on both, to leave the full force of the deadly missile, to strike his wicket instead of his leg, and to end the innings, so far as his side was concerned, by being immediately bowled out. Grateful for his escape, he was about to return to the dry ditch, when he was peremptorily stopped, and told that the other side was going in, apostrophe, and that he was expected to field. Apostrophe is conception of the whole art and mystery of fielding. Apostrophe may be summed up in the three words of serious advice which he privately administered to himself on that trying occasion: avoid the ball. Fortified by this sound and salutary principle, he took his own course, impervious alike to ridicule and abuse. Whenever the ball came near him, he thought of his shins, and got out of the way immediately. Catch it. Apostrophe, apostrophe, stop it. Apostrophe, pitch it up. Were cries that passed by him like the idle wind, that he regarded not. He ducked under it, he jumped over it, he whisked himself away from it on either side. Never once, through the whole innings, did he and the ball come together on anything approaching to intimate terms. The unnatural activity of body which was necessarily called forth for the accomplishment of this result threw Thomas Idle, for the first time in his life, into a perspiration. The perspiration, in consequence of his want of practice in the management of that particular result of bodily activity, was suddenly checked. The inevitable chill succeeded, and that, in its turn, was followed by a fever. For the first time since his birth, Mr. Idle found himself confined to his bed for many weeks together, wasted and worn by a long illness, of which his own disastrous muscular exertion had been the sole first cause. The third occasion on which Thomas found reason to reproach himself bitterly for the mistake of having attempted to be industrious was connected with his choice of a calling in life. Having no interest in the church, he appropriately selected the next best profession for a lazy man in England, the bar. Although the benchers of the Inns of Court have lately abandoned their good old principles, and obliged their students to make some show of studying, in Mr. Idle's time no such innovation as this existed. Young men who aspired to the honorable title of barrister were, very properly, not asked to learn anything of the law, but were merely required to eat a certain number of dinners at the table of their hall, and to pay a certain sum of money, and were called to the bar, as soon as they could prove that they had sufficiently complied with these extremely sensible regulations. Never did Thomas move more harmoniously in concert with his elders and betters than when he was qualifying himself for admission among the barristers of his native country. Never did he feel more deeply what real laziness was in all the serene majesty of its nature than on the memorable day when he was called to the bar, after having carefully abstained from opening his law books during his period of probation, except to fall asleep over them. How he could ever again have become industrious, even for the shortest period, after that great reward conferred upon his idleness, quite passes his comprehension. The kind benchers did everything they could to show him the folly of exerting himself. They wrote out his probationary exercise for him, and never expected him even to take the trouble of reading it through when it was written. They invited him, with seven other choice spirits as lazy as himself, to come and be called to the bar while they were sitting over their wine and fruit after dinner. They put his oaths of allegiance, and his dreadful official denunciations of the Pope and the Pretender, so gently into his mouth, that he hardly knew how the words got there. They wheeled all their chairs softly round from the table, and sat surveying the young barristers with their backs to their bottles, rather than stand up, or adjourn to hear the exercises read. And when Mr. Idle and the seven unlaboring neophytes, ranged in order, as a class, with their backs considerately placed against a screen, had begun, in rotation, to read the exercises which they had not written, even then, each bencher, true to the great lazy principle of the whole proceeding, stopped each neophyte, before he had stammered through his first line, and bowed to him, and told him politely that he was a barrister from that moment. This was all the ceremony. It was followed by a social supper, and by the presentation, in accordance with ancient custom, of a pound of sweetmeats and a bottle of Madeira, offered in the way of needful refreshment, by each grateful neophyte to each beneficent bencher. It may seem inconceivable that Thomas should ever have forgotten the great do-nothing principle instilled by such a ceremony as this, but it is, nevertheless, true, that certain designing students of industrious habits found him out, took advantage of his easy humor, persuaded him that it was discreditable to be a barrister, and to know nothing whatever about the law, and lured him, by the force of their own evil example, into a conveyancer's chambers, to make up for lost time, and to qualify himself for practice at the bar. After a fortnight of self-delusion, the curtain fell from his eyes. He resumed his natural character, and shut up his books. But the retribution which had hitherto always followed his little casual errors of industry followed them still. He could get away from the conveyancer's chambers, but he could not get away from one of the pupils, who had taken a fancy to him, a tall, serious, raw-boned, hard-working, disputatious pupil, with ideas of his own about reforming the law of real property, who has been the scourge of Mr. Idle's existence ever since the fatal day when he fell into the mistake of attempting to study the law. Before that time his friends were all sociable idlers like himself. Since that time the burden of bearing with a hard-working young man has become part of his lot in life. Go where he will now, he can never feel certain that the raw-boned pupil is not affectionately waiting for him round a corner, to tell him a little more about the law of real property. Suffer as he may under the infliction, he can never complain, for he must always remember, with unavailing regret, that he has his own thoughtless industry to thank for first exposing him to the great social calamity of knowing a bore. These events of his past life, with the significant results that they brought about, pass drowsily through Thomas Idle's memory while he lies alone on the sofa at Allonby and elsewhere, dreaming away the time which his fellow apprentice gets through so actively out of doors. Remembering the lesson of laziness which his past disasters teach, and bearing in mind also the fact that he is crippled in one leg because he exerted himself to go up a mountain, when he ought to have known that his proper course of conduct was to stop at the bottom of it, he holds now, and will for the future firmly continue to hold, by his new resolution never to be industrious again, on any pretense whatever, for the rest of his life. The physical results of his accident have been related in a previous chapter. The moral results now stand on record, and, With the enumeration of these, that part of the present narrative which is occupied by the episode of the sprained ankle may now perhaps be considered, in all its aspects, as finished and complete. How do you propose that we get through this present afternoon and evening? Demanded Thomas Idle, after 2 or 3 hours of the foregoing reflections at Allonby. Mr. Goodchild faltered, looked out of window, looked in again, and said, as he had so often said before, there is the sea, and here are the shrimps. Let us eat them. But the wise donkey was at that moment in the act of bolting. Not with the irresolution of his previous efforts which had been wanting in sustained force of character, but with real vigor of purpose. Shaking the dust off his mane and hind feet at Allonby, and tearing away from it, as if he had nobly made up his mind that he never would be taken alive. At sight of this inspiring spectacle, which was visible from his sofa, Thomas Idle stretched his neck and dwelt upon it rapturously. Francis Goodchild, he then said, turning to his companion with a solemn air, this is a delightful little inn, excellently kept by the most comfortable of landladies, and the most attentive of landlords, but the donkey's right. The words, there is the sea, and here are the apostrophe again trembled on the lips of Goodchild, unaccompanied however by any sound. Let us instantly pack the portmanteaus, said Thomas Idle, pay the bill, and order a fly out, with instructions to the driver to follow the donkey. Mr. Goodchild, who had only wanted encouragement to disclose the real state of his feelings, and who had been pining beneath his weary secret, now burst into tears, and confessed that he thought another day in the place would be the death of him. So, the two idle apprentices followed the donkey until the night was far advanced. Whether he was recaptured by the town council, or is bolting at this hour through the United Kingdom, they know not. They hope he may be still bolting. If so, their best wishes are with him. It entered Mr. Idle's head, on the borders of Cumberland, that there could be no idler place to stay at, except by snatches of a few minutes each, than a railway station. An intermediate station on a line, a junction, anything of that sort, Thomas suggested. Mr. Goodchild approved of the idea as eccentric, and they journeyed on and on, until they came to such a station, where there was an inn. Here, said Thomas, we may be luxuriously lazy. Other people will travel for us, as it were, and we shall laugh at their folly. It was a junction station, where the wooden razors before mentioned shaved the air very often, and where the sharp electric telegraph bell was in a very restless condition. All manner of cross lines of rails came zigzagging into it, like a congress of iron vipers, and, a little way out of it, a pointsman in an elevated signal box was constantly going through the motions of drawing immense quantities of beer at a public house bar. In one direction, confused perspectives of embankments and arches were to be seen from the platform. In the other, the rails soon disentangled themselves into two tracks, and shot away under a bridge, and curved round a corner. Sidings were there, in which empty luggage vans and cattle boxes often butted against each other, as if they couldn't agree, and warehouses were there, in which great quantities of goods seemed to have taken the veil of the consistency of tarpaulin, and to have retired from the world without any hope of getting back to it. Refreshment rooms were there. One, for the hungry and thirsty iron locomotives, where their coke and water were ready, and of good quality, for they were dangerous to play tricks with. The other, for the hungry and thirsty human locomotives, who might take what they could get, and whose chief consolation was provided in the form of 3 terrific urns or vases of white metal, containing nothing, each forming a breastwork for a defiant and apparently much injured woman. Established at this station, Mr. Thomas Idle and Mr. Francis Goodchild resolved to enjoy it. But, its contrasts were very violent, and there was also an infection in it. First, as to its contrasts. They were only two, but they were lethargy and madness. The station was either totally unconscious, or wildly raving. By day, in its unconscious state, it looked as if no life could come to it, as if it were all rust, dust, and ashes, as if the last train forever had gone without issuing any return tickets, as if the last engine had uttered its last shriek and burst. One awkward shave of the air from the wooden razor, and everything changed. Tight office doors flew open, panels yielded, books, newspapers, traveling caps and wrappers broke out of brick walls, money chinked, conveyances oppressed by nightmares of luggage came careering into the yard, porters started up from secret places, ditto the much-injured women, the shining bell, who lived in a little tray on stilts by himself, flew into a man's hand and clamored violently. The pointsman aloft in the signal box made the motions of drawing, with some difficulty, hogsheads of beer. Down train. More beer. Up train. More beer. Cross junction train. More beer. Cattle train. More beer. Goods train. Simmering, whistling, trembling, rumbling, thundering. Trains on the whole confusion of intersecting rails, crossing one another, bumping one another, hissing one another, backing to go forward, tearing into distance to come close. People frantic. Exiles seeking restoration to their native carriages, and banished to remoter climes. More beer and more bell. Then, in a minute, the station relapsed into stupor as the stoker of the cattle train, the last to depart, went gliding out of it, wiping the long nose of his oil can with a dirty pocket handkerchief. By night, in its unconscious state, the station was not so much as visible. Something in the air, like an enterprising chemist's established in business on one of the boughs of Jack's beanstalk, was all that could be discerned of it under the stars. In a moment it would break out, a constellation of gas. In another moment, 20 rival chemists, on 20 rival beanstalks, came into existence. Then, the Furies would be seen, waving their lurid torches up and down the confused perspectives of embankments, and arches would be heard to, wailing and shrieking. Then, the station would be full of palpitating trains, as in the day, with the heightening difference, that they were not so clearly seen as in the day, whereas the station walls, starting forward under the gas, like a hippopotamus's eyes, dazzled the human locomotives with the sauce bottle, the cheap music, the bedstead, the distorted range of buildings, where the patent safes are made, the gentleman in the rain with the registered umbrella, the lady returning from the ball with the registered respirator, and all their other embellishments. And now, the human locomotives, creased as to their countenances and purblind as to their eyes, would swarm forth in a heap, addressing themselves to the mysterious urns and the much-injured women, while the iron locomotives, dripping fire and water, shed their steam about plentifully, making the dull oxen in their cages, with heads depressed, and foam hanging from their mouths as their red looks glanced fearfully at the surrounding terrors, seem as though they had been drinking at half-frozen waters, and were hung with icicles. Through the same steam, would be caught glimpses of their fellow travelers, the sheep, getting their white kid faces together, away from the bars, and stuffing the interstices with trembling wool. Also, down among the wheels, of the man with the sledgehammer, ringing the axles of the fast night train, against whom the oxen have a misgiving, that he is the man with the poleaxe who is to come by, and so the nearest of them try to get back, and get a purchase for a thrust at him through the bars. Suddenly, the bell would ring, the steam would stop with one hiss and a yell, the chemists on the beanstalks would be busy, the avenging Furies would bestir themselves, the fast night train would melt from eye and ear, the other trains going their ways more slowly would be heard faintly rattling in the distance like old-fashioned watches running down, the sauce bottle and cheap music retired from view, even the bedstead went to bed, and there was no such visible thing as the station, to vex the cool wind in its blowing, or perhaps the autumn lightning, as it found out the iron rails. The infection of the station was this. When it was in its raving state, the apprentices found it impossible to be there, without laboring under the delusion that they were in a hurry. To Mr. Goodchild, whose ideas of idleness were so imperfect, this was no unpleasant hallucination, and accordingly that gentleman went through great exertions in yielding to it, and running up and down the platform, jostling everybody, under the impression that he had a highly important mission somewhere, and had not a moment to lose. But, to Thomas Idle, this contagion was so very unacceptable an incident of the situation, that he struck on the fourth day, and requested to be moved. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.